Hey, I'm Jonathan Miller, and this is the Housing Helix Podcast. I'm a real estate appraiser, analyst, and blogger based in New York who is interested in pretty much anything related to housing with an analytical bent. The Housing Helix is the real estate conversation in long form with information, analysis, and commentary, as well as insights from housing-related experts that have something interesting to share. This episode and the entire podcast library are available as a free subscription through iTunes and at thehousinghelix.com. I hope you enjoy it. Well, I've been on hiatus from podcasting for the last 6 months. Just got a little hectic, real busy at Miller Samuel, and revamping my blog and website, and thought I'd take a little break. But I've been itching to get back, and I was talking to Barry Ritholtz, my friend, the other day about doing a podcast. And Barry, as many of you know, has a lot to say about a lot of things. And he is just a fantastic storyteller of the economic situation. So I had Barry in, and we touched on the state of the housing market, recession, and his upcoming conference this Tuesday. Because it was so full of material, in podcast parlance, we call this a double wide. It's a two-part interview, the first today, and the second will be on Matrix tomorrow, Thursday. I'd like to label this podcast as R-rated. For those of you that know Barry, he pulls no punches. And if you have little kids around, you might want to put your earphones on. Hope you enjoy it. Well, I'm sitting down with you again, Barry. And actually,
Is this our third podcast?
It feels like the third podcast. Right. What do they say? That it feels like the third podcast. If you're underwater, is that?
I don't know.
That's the the marriage joke. Feels like 5 minutes. Right. Underwater.
Gotcha.
Anyway, it's great to have you. And just to provide some clarification, Barry's other activities include technical support for podcast.
You would have figured it out. You were right there. Yeah, I was coming up on it.
So when Barry came here, I literally couldn't find the record button on my GarageBand application. It's a long story. Anyway, we're here to talk. It's been a while. We're here to talk about a couple things. One, I'd like to cover your upcoming conference.
Sure.
I'd also like to talk a little bit about your thoughts about housing. And this whole, I want to understand what the likelihood is that we're going to go into a recession, mm-hmm. what it means, and the crazy sort of percentage predictions that you keep reading about. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the conference.
Sure,
it's called the Big Picture Conference.
Right, second one we've done. We did one. We seem to do it right in the middle of mayhem. The last one we did was 2009. It was everything was in free fall.
Yeah.
And it was really, really fascinating, and people have been pressing me, hey, you guys have to do another conference.
Where is it?
It's going to be at the New York Athletic Club, which is Central Park South, on Tuesday, October 11th.
Okay.
If you go to my site, you'll see, go to ritholtz.com, you'll see links, you'll see the schedule, you'll see a whole bunch of things. Right. Really interesting collection of people.
Yeah, who do you have? I knew half the names. It was
Some pretty well-known names, some people that you may not know but are just super insightful. There's a woman who runs a site called Visualizing Economics.
Oh, I tried,
Catherine.
She was raising money for her book.
Kickstarter.
Through Kickstarter.
Right.
And I missed the deadline, but
blew up. She tried to raise like 20 or 30, got like a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah.
And the book is going to be great. She's going to give away certain books there. She's going to do a whole presentation.
Yeah, it's
just
phenomenal.
A really smart way of looking at data.
Right.
Like normally you get these horrific tables from the BLS and these boring
graphs from Excel spreadsheets.
That's right. Or Econometric generates some good graphs.
Yes.
She does really fascinating work, and there's such a nice way of depicting information that communicates. I describe the hierarchy of knowledge is starts with data,
right.
Moves up to information, goes to knowledge, and then it's wisdom. Those are the four steps. Data is just 9.2%. Well, what does that mean? It's just data. Information is the unemployment rate is 9.2%, up from 6%, but down from the high of 10%. Across the historic recessions, blah, 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 blah. But that's information.
Right.
Knowledge is then, what does that mean in terms of what you can do in the stock market? What about your job? Whether or not you should be changing jobs, buying houses, whatever. And then lastly, wisdom is, on top of all of that, is just sage way to take all the below and interpret it.
Yeah, I look at the last two steps as context.
Right.
You know, you have the raw data, then what do you do
with it
and how does it fit in the rest of the world?
The last three steps, and data is just raw numbers. Information is giving you some context. Knowledge is even broader context.
Right.
And wisdom is obviously actionable ideas, what you can do with that knowledge and information.
So give me some other names.
So who else? So there are two guys, Sal Arnick and Joe Saluzzi. From Themis Trading, these guys were the early identifiers of problems with high-frequency trading. They're the first ones to figure out what the flash crash meant. They're 30-year market watchers. They're traders and institutional brokers for decades. And they really figured out before pretty much anyone else what was going on with this high-frequency trading. We had dinner a couple of months ago.
Now, just for my listeners that may not know what that is, what is high-frequency trading?
What most trading is us humans. I sell 1,000 stock shares, you buy 1,000 shares. That's normal institutional or individual trading. When a bunch of uber high-powered computers located right by the exchange in order to save the time it takes the electrons to travel to New Jersey or Connecticut, like it's literally co-located 8 feet. In fact, people are even arguing if you're on one end of the rack or the other end of the server rack, 20 feet, does that make a difference?
Right.
Electrons moving at the speed of light. In fact, it turns out, due to quantum mechanics, that certain servers are actually trading in the future. It hasn't happened yet. There was this fascinating, fascinating discussion of how you're 15 milliseconds in the future, what actually is taking place, hasn't happened yet. And so these guys have done this whole analysis of all these high-powered, algorithm-driven computers. It's not us carbon-based units. It's just silicon.
Right.
And according to them, here's a spoiler, they believe it's hollowing out the capital structure of the markets. It means we're likely to have more frequent crashes.
More volatility.
More volatility. That this isn't healthy in any way, shape, or form. And the more this is allowed to go on. Now, keep in mind, 10 years ago, all these exchanges were not for profit. They were essentially looked at as public utilities operating on behalf of the investor. All these high-frequency algo-driven servers, hey, it's a zero-sum gain. If they're taking a slice of the pie, someone else ain't getting any.
Right.
And that means that mom and pop's pension fund is being ripped off a little bit because these guys get to sniff orders before it goes to the exchange.
I see.
And ultimately, only shameless whores that are publicly traded exchanges would so egregiously steal from the public. It's legal, so I can't call them criminals.
Right.
But if they were not for profits, no one would ever think of doing this. It's just absolutely shameless.
And it's all publicly traded exchanges.
NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, all this stuff. You know, after the Great Crash in 29 and the Depression, you lost an entire generation of investors for 25 years.
Right.
It took from 29 to 54 to get back to break even. And my pet theory is people said, hey, the whole game is rigged. That you had to have new people born, grow up, get jobs, and start investing.
To not have the wisdom of the past.
The knowledge of what a scam it was. And so that's the danger now, is that you'll just lose a whole generation
of investors.
Sure. And I think that we're probably 35 to 40%.
Rough parallel with housing in the sense of the generation now coming up. I remember during the boom, you had everybody in their was buying things out of the cradle. You know, they were trying to buy housing, and they had never experienced a decline. Now you have a generation that
has only experienced a decline,
and so you have this sort of postulate, are we going to be an all rental nation, which I, my own view is no way. I think we're reverting to the mean in terms of home ownership.
That's right. We were low 60s 20, right. 30 years ago. We peaked around 70%. Where are we now? 66%.
Yeah, 66.
So.
Yeah.
So a slip
and
a little
Fannie
further
Mae,
back.
Fannie Mae's stated goal was 75%.
There you go. Everybody gets a house.
Right. It's a right.
You win a house, and you win a look. Here's the problem. Here's why I don't think you'll lose a generation with housing. You got to live somewhere.
Right.
As long as there's a mortgage interest deduction, and as long as better neighborhoods have better schools. Every time you have a household formation, every time there's a marriage and a kid on the way, you know, there's a reason why the real estate in certain areas surrounding New York City is so much more expensive than areas further away.
Right.
You know, real estate is a function of the local job market. It's a function of the local school district and a lot of other elements, but people are going to want to live in certain areas.
That's why the housing boom passed by in upstate New York.
They didn't have that Vegas
and the bills weren't
scam
that good
going on. That's right.
Back then.
But you also, you know, why did you have that boom in Las Vegas? It was
right.
absolutely insane.
Right.
You know, wait, 2-hour commute to where? There's
right.
no jobs.
The exurbs and
yeah,
the mansions in the exurbs.
And it's a friggin' desert. It's,
right.
it's one of those things that is not explainable rationally.
Right. It's irrational. So the other thing I wanted to touch on, and we can delve back into the conference, is you've been sort of on a roll with housing.
Yes.
And writing about housing.
Love writing about it. It's fascinating.
And it's funny because you and I, unbeknownst to each other, were both on Bloomberg Radio today.
Yes.
And I think we were sandwiched, or we were the sandwich, and the in between us was someone who was much more sort of optimistic.
I was on with someone who is optimistic.
Yeah.
You always have to fight the urge to call the other guy a schmuck. It's really, it's a challenge. That's an old lawyer aphorism, which is when the law goes against you, argue the facts. If the facts aren't going your way, stress the law. And when both the law and the facts are against you, call the other lawyer an asshole. I mean, that's an old lawyer joke. But you know,
I never knew that, but I did process that in my mind.
it really is true. Look, a lot of the people who are in the media work for shops that are fully invested at all times, long only. So to them, their only tool is a hammer.
Right.
So every dip is a buying opportunity. Every sell-off makes market cheap. You know, every
right.
time we have a crash, you got to back up the truck. And so
it's always a good time to buy.
It's like the National Association of Realtors ads. It's always a good time to buy or sell a house. I want them to, you know, the movie where The Invention of Lying. It would
right.
have been great to see that ad. It's always a good time to generate a commission causing
transaction.
Right.
So and just as an aside, and you've told me this before, but I don't think on the podcast is you did some research on the affordability index.
Ah, yes.
And how many months since, what, did it start in 73?
Didn't go all that far back. I just looked from the late 90s.
Okay, late 90s.
Through the boom, you know,
right.
from 96 till today.
And how many months in that period was it not a good time to buy?
Was it not affordable according to the
yes.
NAR Housing Affordability Index?
Yes.
One.
When was that?
I don't remember the exact month. It might have been like August 06.
Okay.
I mean, I have it on the blog if you
so
pull
right
it up.
So right at the peak.
Yeah, it wasn't affordable for a month. Stop and think about how completely and totally absurd that is. I look at most of the National Association of Realtors data as – I look at all of the commentary as laughable. I look at most of the data as suspect.
Right.
I don't want their information. Just give me the raw data.
Yes.
And so
you don't want the insight because it's
what
well, they're
insight?
A trade group.
Right.
Right.
But there are other trade groups that are less. They don't have acid in the water.
Right.
With the water cooler there is because
it's
filled with hallucinogenics.
Because it's interesting. Because and just as an aside,
look at the rail index. Look at the Retailers Association.
Right.
There's some correlation with reality.
Right.
and what ends up happening with the NAR is it works, it's counterproductive. I think I emailed you way back when, it's on the blog somewhere, it was from the Palm Beach Post. A bunch of realtors fired off an angry letter to, it was either the state NAR or the national saying, hey, what are you idiots doing?
Yeah.
I can't get, and this was like 06, 07 when there's still some money to be had. I can't get people to price housing realistically, says these realtors, because they're believing the crap that you idiots are cranking out.
Right.
And they're not only $100,000 behind the market, they're always two steps. So as the market drops, drop another 50, they're still $100,000 behind the market.
It's called chasing the market.
Yes, that's exactly right.
You're always dropping your price, but you're doing it too late. And you,
Wayne
you
Gretzky. Can't sell.
Yes. Always anticipate where the puck is going
to
be.
Right. Skate to where the puck will be, not to where it is. So when realtors are complaining, and understand, I'm the son of a realtor.
Right.
This was dinner table conversation growing up. I just laugh at this stuff because it's like just astonishing. I'm sure you have as many war stories as I do. They're
plenty,
just nuts.
Plenty. And it's interesting, just a dynamic to keep aware of is if you look at the editorial coming out of like their publications, it's relatively neutral. It's the research piece that
just backwards.
Is wildly optimistic,
right.
And it should be the
right.
other
should
way around,
be
or at least consistent.
Right. You want the research to be cold-blooded,
neutral.
Objective, neutral.
Right.
If you want to editorialize, look, here's the bottom line. 63% of the country live in occupant-owned homes, or at least occupant-financed
right.
homes.
Right, 2-1.
Right. Now, here's the problem with that. Of the homes with mortgages mm-hmm. of now let's of the 63%, I believe the data is 30 something percent have no mortgage.
Yes.
So of the remaining homes, which I guess is half the households in the United States, about a quarter of them are underwater.
Yeah. One
right.
in four.
So that's the math. 1 in 4 with mortgages, but the total with mortgages is only 2/3.
Right.
So you end up with, it's not as bad as it sounds at first blush, but it's still pretty ugly. I have something in the Washington Post on, but probably by the time this is out, that looks at some of the data on housing.
Just to interrupt you for a second. So you write a weekly column for the Post?
Twice a month in the Sunday business section. Only this Sunday they're doing the quarterly. It comes out Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So my Sunday piece will be out tomorrow. And some of the numbers, some 8 million people are 30 days late
yes.
on their mortgage. That's just a horrifying
right.
number. And then the other data point was the percent of foreclosures, way off the 9% peak
right.
at about 3.5%, but
that's
far, far above the 1% that
right.
it should be.
And not only that, but it's almost meaningless because all that's been on hold
right.
with the RoboSigner, it's been about
scandal.
A year.
You saw the California news. The California is not going to participate
yes,
in the national.
What does that mean to? I mean, to me, it seems like it creates a lot more confusion. Isn't one of the problems with the servicers is that they're in some ways afraid to initiate foreclosure activities right now because if they do, they could be out of sync with whatever the attorney generals agree to with
I don't
the
think
larger
it,
servicers or
I'm
not?
I'm not sure that it's that specific.
Mm-hmm.
Look, here's the problem. You know, we had the UBS rogue trader
yes.
situation a couple
$2.3 billion.
Yeah, it was a couple of billion dollars between friends.
It's real money.
A billion here, a billion there. I've argued that there's, by the way, you notice that these rogue traders are always 28, 30 years old.
They're very young.
And they're always, it's always money losing. Now here's the reality. There are no such thing as rogue traders. There are only rogue banks. And you don't hear about this guy or his peers who are making $1 billion. You don't hear any of these things. The banks are the one who are giving them capital. The banks are the
yes.
one who are giving them leverage. The banks are the one who have the obligation to supervise and oversee this.
So in
how do you hide $2 billion in losses?
Right.
For
a company.
2 years.
Right.
It's so stop and think about it. I drew the parallel between the UBS rogue bankers and the RoboSigners.
Right.
Because when you have – here's the biggest argument I can make against bailing out banks. When you take a bank that is so grossly incompetent, whose management is just such – the expression in my office, I don't know if we could curse on the
– Absolutely.
All right. The expression in the office is – when senior management are just fucktards, that's the only only word to describe them, they're fucktarded, you're going to end up with a company that does stuff in a horrible way. If they're so incompetent that they can't survive,
right.
Stop and think about it. The prime directive for every living creature, organism, society,
survive.
Entity is to survive. If they're so fucktarded they can't survive, then you got to think everything else they do
is suspect. At
that's
a minimum.
That's being generous. It is just
so
a disaster.
Are you saying, like, with a quote-unquote rogue trader, that you could have, it's just a higher probability, you could have a rogue trader that made money, and it's
they're not
sort
called
of
rogues when they're making
right,
money.
Right, exactly.
You only hear about them when they lose them. Money, they take them out and throw them under the bus. I suspect that if they didn't know this guy was doing it, they had a suspect. How do you, like, misplace $2 billion?
Yeah.
I had it here a moment ago. What did I do with that?
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody had to be looking the other way. Hey, the guy's been making money. Let's give him a look. At a certain point, I mean, you don't just stick it in a drawer. It's $2 billion. It's a computer transaction. It's not like they go to the vault and pull out a stack of bills.
It's complicated to maintain that.
That's it. So somebody screwed up somewhere in order for that to happen. But screwed up or look the other way or whatever it is, it all goes back to, if you're that grossly negligent as an entity that you have to be rescued by the government, then I guarantee you lots and lots of your other policies and procedures are a disaster, which is why so many of the bailed out banks have robo-signing issues, have syndication issues, have mortgage bundling issues. From every step, from the underwriting to the loan approval process to the securitization to the servicing of defaults is a disaster.
It's systemic because, within the institution.
Right. It's a cancer-ridden institution. If you have an entity that is just that internally messed up that it can't even survive itself,
right?
You know, how are you going to go out and run a marathon?
And this was sort of one of the themes in your book, Bailout Nation, was this idea that we are a nation of bailouts.
Right.
And
have become that. We never used to be.
Right. And I think the idea, or the point you're making, is that by bailing out, you're not rewarding companies for good, that have good behavior.
Right. You're punishing companies that have good behavior. Right. You're rewarding the miscreants. You're rewarding the malfeasance who basically engaged in such reckless behavior as to commit suicide. You know, I had this argument with a guy who wrote a book about the murder of Lehman Brothers.
Right.
The murder of Lehman Brothers? Who told Lehman Brothers to tell Warren Buffett to go jump with his capital?
Right.
Who told Lehman Brothers to go 40-1?
Right.
Who told Lehman Brothers, hey, this mortgage thing is where you want to place all your chips?
Right.
Who told them to go back up the truck on derivatives? It's plain and simply, Lehman Brothers, like Bear Stearns, like AIG, just committed corporate suicide.
Right.
It's no other way to describe it. And yet people want to blame everybody but the corporate management. Hey, I jokingly say, just as there are no atheists in foxholes, all the free marketers become screaming 10-year-old schoolgirls, oh, bail us out, when as soon as there's any trouble. It's amazing how few – I mean, I had
a – Selective capitalism?
I love Larry Kudlow. I was on his show, and he was begging for a Bear Stearns. Hey, Larry, I'm sorry. Bear Stearns was your, you know, alma mater, but they fucked up. They had to go.
Right.
And we made a terrible mistake bailing him out. In fact, had we said to Bear, sorry, it's not our thing, and if Jamie Dimon comes to – You know, if the Fed had any cojones, when Jamie Dimon came to them, the Fed would have had to say, look, here's the deal. You have, you know, they have $8 trillion in derivative exposure. You're their single biggest counterparty. If they go belly up, you're probably going to get killed. So my advice to you is buy them before they blow you up. Otherwise, we'll be liquidating you next.
Right.
You know, that's what a man does. That's what a capitalist does.
Right.
Not somebody who gets his arm twisted by demon, who's now completely and totally out of control.
Right.
You know, he is the next major CEO in my book who's going to need a major humbling. I don't know when it happens.
Right.
But he's running around, you know, screaming at everybody.
Yes.
And everybody forgets J.P. Morgan got lucky. They had their derivative and mortgage screw up in the early 2000s. So when they had to liquidate, there was a bid. When everybody else had to liquidate, they
market,
got pennies. Right.
Right. Right.
So he got 80 cents on the dollar. Everybody else got a nickel.
Right.
That's the only reason why everybody thinks he's such a genius.
Shape.
He just got lucky.
So
no genius in my book.
So we were originally talking about California and the California backing out of this agreement, services agreement.
Thank goodness.
If you had to sort of characterize the state of housing in a national context today, where are we?
So we were three standard deviations above historic metrics, whether you're looking at rent versus buy, housing stock as a percentage of GDP, or right. Median income versus median home prices. That was pretty much it. We've fallen about 32%, which puts us about 5% overvalued. We haven't flushed this out. We haven't gone overshooting to the downside, which ultimately is healthy for that market. It creates bargains. It clears out. It moves houses from weak holders to strong holders. You know, it's not good for the economy for a person to be mortgage poor, rent poor. If you're in a house, every last dime goes to the mortgage. You're not hiring the guy to redo your bathroom. You're not hiring a babysitter because you're going out to dinner.
Just hanging on by your
fingernails. Right, you're on by your fingernails, and you're just hoping for the best. And it's not how. Meanwhile, you could take the same house down the road. You can rent for half. It's purposeless. So right now, we're 5% overvalued. It doesn't take much. You could just go sideways for 2 or 3 years, and you're back to fair value. Here's the risk factor. You asked about recession. Right now, I have us at greater than 50-50 chance of recession. 6 months ago, it was at 10%. Over the summer, it was at 30%. August, we moved that up to 40%. There are a lot of different metrics that go into our guesstimate as to where we are.
Give me sort of a layman's logic, not the secret sauce, but you know, I hear this all the time. You know, it's a 30% chance of recession, a 20%.
Stephen Roach joked that.
What does that mean?
When he used to say he would never go over 40%. That was as bearish as he was allowed to get when he was at Morgan Stanley on the sell side when he was in the U.S. Look, nobody knows what the future is. Anytime I hear someone say, we're not going to be in a recession, I don't know what the hell is going to happen in the future. And to be blunt, neither does anybody else. So, look, the weatherman who says there's a 90% chance of rain tomorrow and it's a bright, sunny day, he wasn't wrong. It was just the 10% came in. So it's a nice forecasting cheat to say, we really don't know what's going to happen. There's no reason to guess. There's so many variables between now and then. I'd rather put it in a percentage term. Some of the things we look at is percentage change year over year in GDP, weekly leading economic indicators from ECRI. We look at the overall stock market. We look at the trend in.
Isn't ECRI talking about a recession?
They're saying that the odds are now that we've tipped into a recession.
Meaning that we're already in one?
We're in one. We're about to be in one.
Right.
I think the exact phrase they used was it would just about be impossible today for policymakers to stop the next recession. At this point, I don't disagree with that. I don't see evidence that we're in a recession now, but you continue to see the deceleration of economic data, and that tends to eventually become sort of self-fulfilling. Suddenly people get nervous, they throttle back their spending, they've already throttled back their hiring.
Yes.
And so you get this little bit of a downward spiral. Keynes talked about the paradox of thrift, which is in a recession people stop spending and therefore
it makes it worse.
Which, by the way, I'm amazed that the people trashing Keynes, they don't understand him. During a recession, Keynes would say the government should be cutting taxes and increasing spending to make up for the lack of private sector and consumer spending. What we did wrong was in the 2000s. During an expansion, the government should be raising taxes to balance their budget and reducing their spending to let the private sector, to not crowd out the private sector. We did the opposite.
Right.
We cut taxes and we raised spending.
Reactive
we made the deficit
instead
much
of proactive.
Worse.
Proactive.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And so here's the $14 trillion question. To a consumer, a layperson, when you say, you know, we have a 40% chance of recession, what?
Now I'm saying better than 50.
Okay, so better, whatever the forecast or whatever, you know, anybody picks and everybody goes, oh my God, I don't want a recession. What does
Why don't you want a recession? Let me stop you right there. Here's the reality. I apologize for interrupting.
No.
But so during the last set of flooding, not the most recent one from Hurricane Irene, but over the summer, the Mississippi flooded.
Yeah.
right? And this guy is standing on the banks of the Mississippi where his house once was, but it's gone.
Right.
And he said, look, you know, we rebuilt in 1990 and, you know, this is a 100-year flood like the one in 2000 that we rebuilt. So we'll rebuild again, you know, with God and the church on our right. side. We'll rebuild this. And the community will help us. And all I'm thinking is, wait, you got flooded out in 1990. You got flooded out in 2000. How the hell is this a 100-year flood?
Right.
This is a once-a-decade flood. Hey, see you in 10 years. It's now 2010. This is three...
Give FEMA a call and change the map.
Right. See you in 10 years for the next one. This is not a 100-year flood. If you live on the banks of the Mississippi and you're surprised when every decade your house is flooded away, you're not paying attention. Recessions come along on a fairly regular basis, 4 to 8 years. We get into trouble like a drunk who doesn't want to suffer the hangover. So the drunk has a hair of the dog that bit him, and instead of getting the hangover, he just extends the binge until he's an alcoholic. That's what we've done. We don't want a recession. Greenspan cut rates ridiculously low in 2000.
Held them too long.
Caused all these other problems, or at least lit the spark in a room full of gasoline vapors, and you know, here we are, we're doing the same thing again. The recessions serve a purpose. They clear out the excess investment. They, you know, the expression I once heard is that money returns to its rightful owners. The people who are irresponsible and speculative and highly leveraged, they get wiped out, as they should.
Hence the name correction.
That's right. It's a correction.
It corrects it.
It corrects. And so... Again, the housing is a perfect example. We don't want to allow home prices to correct. The government, the Fed, everybody has done everything they can to prevent it. First-time tax credits. You don't need a first-time tax credit.
But they actually, by trying to prevent it, they actually made it worse.
They're just spreading it out over time.
Delaying the resolution. Delay. But I guess my question was...
Rip the Band-Aid off.
Right. My question was... When you know, it's sort of like, and I think I've probably used this analogy before. My father was in the Army. They used to say, don't do this or you'll get a gig. And don't do this or you'll get a gig. And everybody's like, all the soldiers would say, well, what's a gig? I don't know, but I don't want one. And sort of this unknown sort of big, bad sort of cloud. And I feel like when you say recession,
right,
to the sort of everyday, you know, person walking down the street, going to the grocery store, whatever. What does it mean?
A recession?
In general terms, like how does it change your life?
So, well, it depends if you're laid off or not. You know, right. The old joke is a recession is when your neighbor loses a job. A depression is when you lose your job.
Right.
The formal NBER definition is a peak to trough drop in economic indicators. It's things like retail spending and employment and industrial production. And it's more than just a little drop. It's pervasive and it's persistent. And so you have an extended period of time where economic activity contracts. Now, to put that into a little context, you know, we had prior to this last recession, we had a $14.2 billion economy. And in the worst of the recession, it was like a $13.65 trillion economy. And so that's really a minor, you know, numerically it's a minor. Look, people still have to feed themselves. They still have to live somewhere. They still have to send their kids to school. They still have to eat. So the vast majority of the economic activity continues along. You're going to heat your house. You're going to use electricity. You know, $13.7 trillion of economic activity is going to keep going. And as we saw, even in the midst of the last collapse, people still bought iPhones, they still bought iPods, they still bought all sorts of things. Google still sold a ton of ads. It's on the margins, and really that's where a lot of economic activity takes place because most markets are fairly balanced. The buyers and sellers are equal. It's at the margin that
Do you think the American consumer is being overly sort of pummeled with negative information that's out of context, like we were talking earlier, with the world around them, or is this real? That's the end of part one of my two-part conversation with Barry Ritholtz. Look for part two tomorrow on my blog, Matrix.
That's it for this edition of the Housing Helix podcast. As always, you can send comments and recommend guests to my email address, jmiller@millersamuel.com. This episode and the entire podcast library are available as a free subscription through iTunes and at thehousinghelix.com. So until next time, I'm Jonathan Miller, and thanks for listening to the Housing Helix Podcast.